the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
The relationship between US President Donald Trump and multi-billionaire Elon Musk has been generating a lot of headlines, to say the least. This week, eyebrows were raised as Trump went to bat for Musk, promoting his Tesla cars on the front lawn of the White House. But our first guest believes the relationship between the two men will turn sour. We caught up with Edward Luce, US national editor and columnist at the Financial Times earlier, and I first asked him about a quote from Elon Musk, that he loved Donald Trump as much as a straight man can love another. How would he characterize their relationship now? And are there signs that it's changing?
How to characterize it? I mean, I think I'd need to be a world-class psychologist to really get into the answer to that question. You have two, I mean, arguably sort of gargantuan narcissists. And at times it feels Washington's too small to house the both of them, who are in this codependent relationship, Trump having, of course, received nearly $300 million from Musk for his election campaign, plus, of course, the services of X, his incalculably valuable support there for Trump's campaign. Therefore, there's a great deal of Trump gratitude as well as admiration for the fact that this man is the richest man in the world. And then on Musk's side, Trump has given him free rein in a role that has no precedent in US history over the federal government to reform, to hire, to fire, to close down agencies, to take over control of payments systems at the Social Security Administration, at the Treasury. There is no precedent for this. The richest, you know, oligarch in the land having an unconfirmed, unelected free reign over the federal government, that there's no sort of roadmap in US history, nor from what I can discover in the history of any other serious democracy.
But when you look at the way that that relationship is changing, even aside from Trump-Musk, what about Elon Musk and how he's regarded by the wider Trump circle and senior figures in the cabinet, senior Republicans? He seems to have really annoyed a lot of people. Is there a sense now that he's becoming either a liability or a bit of an albatross for Donald Trump?
There is amongst a lot of people around him. And of course, there's a great deal of resentment from cabinet principals, Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, being one, Sean Duffy, the Transportation Secretary, being another. But there are plenty, because Musk's DOGE, the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, has been under their noses, hiring, firing, closing agencies, taking over digital networks within their departments without getting their permission. Of course, that would engender deep resentments very, very quickly. And that all came to a head in a cabinet meeting. On Capitol Hill, senior Republicans have sort of bent the knee to Trump and to everything that Trump is doing. But there isn't a single Republican who in private that I know of isn't as deeply resentful of Musk as Trump's cabinet officers are. So, you know, we're left with just Trump, and he's the only one that matters.
Is there any evidence that Trump himself might be going a bit cool on Elon Musk?
Not really. I mean, he did rein in Musk allegedly a little bit, clipped his wings a little bit at the end of that cabinet meeting when he affirmed that it was cabinet principals who had control over their own departments. But other than that, the love fest continues. Trump, a couple of days ago, did another, I mean, we're living in an era of unprecedentedness, but another unprecedented act, which was to advertise Tesla on White House property, gave this sort of remarkable commercial with Musk standing there next to him, a Tesla in front of them, a Cybertruck parked behind it, and of course, Musk's ubiquitous four-year-old son, X, towing along. It was a sign that Trump is still very much got this, for want of a better term, man crush on Musk, and vice versa.
Well, Elon Musk has offered millions more millions more dollars to put it into Trump's political action committee. And he was actually turned down.
Yes, he's been turned down repeatedly. He wants to keep pumping money in. I mean, when you're worth $300 and something billion, money really is worth nothing. So he can, that spigot can go on indefinitely.
So why do they not want any more of his money then?
I think the idea amongst people around Trump in his political operations, but not Trump himself, is that it gives the appearance that Musk has essentially bought the presidency lock, stock and barrel. That it's at a time when we're now getting quite rowdy town halls in Republican districts where Republican congressmen are getting really quite angry voters facing them over the role of DOGE and the firing of civil servants and the firing of regulators, that the appearance that Musk is now owning Trump even more than he hitherto did own Trump, is politically unwise.
You've written this week about that relationship, and you've gone as far as saying that the question is how Trump will get rid of Musk, not whether he will.
At some point, this, I mean, I have absolutely no evidence for this. This is more deductive and speculative reasoning. But at some point, this cannot last. This is such a volatile, legally contested, politically wild situation. I'm not alone in such thinking. It's a pretty widespread consensus here that this is too unstable a relationship to continue as it is.
Is there a danger that Elon Musk would just become quite toxic, really, for a lot of people? I'm thinking about some of the things that he has retweeted, and he recently retweeted Hitler didn't murder millions message, where the message seemed to be saying that it wasn't him, it was his public servants or administrators who did it, and this was retweeted by Musk. Is there a sense in which if that sort of level of toxicity continues, that it might accelerate a breakdown in that relationship?
It might well do. I mean, he called a senator, Mark Kelly, a former astronaut and soldier from Arizona, visited Ukraine last week. And Musk described him as a traitor on his site. And so that kind of thing is now a daily event, well, hourly practically. He tweets, I believe, once every 7 minutes, and that's a 24-hour-a-day measure, which is a sign, if ever there was one, of compulsive and addictive behaviour.
And he's had a go at other politicians. He referred to Poland's foreign minister.
He did indeed, and that was Radek Sikorski, who pointed out that Starlink, the services it provides to the Ukrainian military on the front lines, is something that Poland partly pays for, after Musk himself had hinted thickly that he would withdraw that service from Ukraine. So he's kind of out of control, yes.
So he sort of posted, so far, be quiet, small man, there's no substitute for Starlink.
Indeed. And it turns out that this isn't too good for Musk's sort of business interests. I mean, we've seen what's happened with Tesla sales in the United States and across Europe. Well, now we're getting a similar reaction with Starlink, with SpaceX, which is people are looking for alternative providers. I believe there is a French provider which could potentially supplant Starlink in Ukraine. There is Blue Origin here, which is owned by Musk's rival, Jeff Bezos. And there are accelerated incentives for people to create alternatives to SpaceX, because Musk is just seen as a very volatile and unpredictable person.
Given the scale of his wealth, what's in it for him? Why do you think he wants to stay in the picture to increase that wealth? Is it just about power? What's your take on that?
I've got that ABBA song, you know, money, money, money must be funny in a rich man's world, going in my head as you were asking that question. I think at a certain point, you know, money doesn't really have too much marginal extra value once you're into the hundreds of billions, and power and ego come into it. And I think the idea that a lot on the Silicon Valley right, the controllers of technology, the pioneers and innovators, the titans of AI, essentially standing taller and seeing further than anyone else in this democracy, and therefore should be given outsized control over it because they are the geniuses. This sort of godlike self-image that some of those people get when they look in the mirror is clearly an affliction that Trump, that Musk suffers from. So I think this is going way beyond money and business interests. This is about his role in reshaping American, the US Republic.
If you look at that Trump-Musk relationship, and if you're right, the things do begin to sour, where do you see the early indications of that? What should people watch out for in that relationship as possible flashpoints or indicators of that?
Well, you know, Trump is very obliging in many respects. And often these defining moments, as we saw with Zelensky, happen live in front of TV cameras. I think probably Musk is unwise to be taking Trump for granted, and the way in which he sort of saunters in, talking of Zelensky, without wearing a suit, in a t-shirt with a MAGA, a black MAGA cap on, and his four-year-old picking his nose. This is probably a little bit too much of a sort of dog leaving its scent, you know, in the Oval Office. This is probably something that Trump's not going to indefinitely tolerate, no matter how much money Musk offers to give him.
Do they differ on China?
Well, so far, Trump is towing a Musk line on China, which is very dovish. Trump, until sometime last year, and I date that to the sort of beginnings of the Musk-Trump relationship, was a hawk on China. He's now a dove. And of course, you know, Musk's business interests in China are big, and he depends on them a lot more now that his sales of Tesla are plummeting elsewhere. So China is one good test. If Trump turns hawkish again, that would be a sign that Musk's influence is waning.
If you look at the tariffs issue and the issue of the economy under Donald Trump, it's as if something changed in the last week or two, because many people felt that a lot of the stuff around tariffs was really rhetoric, and it was about threats and utilising the threat of tariffs in order to get something else. In the last week or so, there's a growing feeling now, and Trump has signalled this by saying we may have to take a bit of pain, there may be a bit of a transition. Is there a growing sense now among consumers, among the public, among businesses, that there may well be a recession coming in the US?
Yeah, there's been a number of sort of early warning signs of a possibility of a recession. One of which, of course, is Trump himself admitting to that. This idea that in order to get to the sunlit uplands I've been promising you, we have to go through pain. Another is the very sharp decline in consumer confidence. Another is the rising consumer expectation of higher inflation and therefore higher interest rates, which would hit their bottom line straight away. And of course, the mood music around these tariff wars. One day they're on, next day they're off, the day after they've been doubled. The sort of lack of investor certainty that I think the memo has finally hit Wall Street, that, you know, this could actually be quite bloody, this could be quite costly, this could be quite volatile and indefinitely.
But if Trump decides, as he has done, to freeze US aid and it affects AIDS vaccines in South America and medication and all kinds of, let's say, for example, on the issue of Ukraine. On a lot of these issues, maybe a lot of Americans, maybe a lot of Republican voters are not overly exercised about what he does on those issues. But if it starts to hit them in the pocket, and if there is a real economic downturn, could the narrative, Trump is there for 4 years, but could the narrative change very quickly in America?
I think you could see a relatively quick change, but not necessarily a dramatic one. Do not underestimate the degree to which different parts of America are getting their information and therefore their scapegoats. Do not underestimate the degree to which Musk can weaponize, as he has been, X in order to spread alternative narratives. He's already helped tilt opinion on Ukraine. Against Ukraine. which was fairly sort of strongly settled until recently. So who would be to blame for economic pain that Americans might feel in the coming months is by no means an obvious thing to predict. It's a very distorted sort of Alice in Wonderland information space that we're living in nowadays.
What's the atmosphere like in the US? I was reading recently about growing tension in offices and workplaces where people have different politics. They may have always had different politics, but it's really beginning to come to the fore now. What's it like? Are Americans talking about all of this?
There is tension, for sure, particularly in Washington, D.C., where I'm based. But actually, there's a surprising lack of resistance and pushback to Trump, like we saw at the beginning of his first term in 2017. We're not really seeing a repeat of that. I teach up at Brown University once a week in Providence, Rhode Island. Very, very little student protests going on. You know, not much agitation on the streets. The Democratic Party is, I think, widely seen as being at odds with itself, not united, lacking a clear leader and lacking a clear narrative, lacking a clear pushback. Civil society, it's sort of ad hoc, but there's no real unity in how you would oppose Trump. So we're really down to the courts. Some judges are putting stay. There is some speed bumps being put in by various legal rulings, but no roadblocks yet.
Donald Trump and the new administration, they have threatened to or actually withdrawn some funding for research in some universities because they've said they're not happy at that university's ability to deal with political protests, particularly around Israel and Gaza.
Yes, so Columbia University is the example that Trump is choosing to make. He's withheld, so far withheld, $400 million in research on the grounds that it's not done enough to protect its Jewish students. Columbia having been the site of some of the most agitated and conspicuous protests after October the 7th. I don't think anybody is taking Trump's pretext at face value. There is a much larger sort of war on universities that he's planning, a war on higher education.
What is that war?
The war is really to bring down the woke elites. And I've no confidence that Trump would lose that one. You know, if he decides, for example, to tax Ivy League endowments, Harvard, Princeton, etc., there will be outrage from the so-called cognitive elites, the readers of the New York Times, the listeners to NPR and the faculties at the Ivy Leagues themselves. But I suspect public opinion would quite enjoy such a spectacle. So the war on the universities is going to be about withholding federal funding, particularly for the sciences, whilst universities comply with very strict free speech rules that, that the Trump administration is going to foist upon them.
And you wrote about one individual who was arrested in relation to speaking at a pro-Palestinian event. And he has been threatened with deportation, although he's married to an American woman and he has a green card.
Yes, he's called Mahmoud Khalil. He's a 30-year-old Columbia graduate who spoke at some of these demonstrations at which Hamas, pro-Hamas literature allegedly was handed out. And ICS, the U.S. immigration, arrested him, spirited him away to a detention facility in Louisiana. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, saying he will deport him. Now, of course, this is not legal and will need to be fought through the courts. So Mahmoud Khalil's case is an extremely important one, because if being at an event where literature is handed out counts as anti-national activity and or aid to terrorism, then every green card holder in the country and US citizens themselves are vulnerable to whatever arbitrary interpretation. That's why this Mahmoud Khalil case is critically important.
I suppose finally, Edward, on this side of the Atlantic, a lot of people in Ireland, I'm sure in the UK and elsewhere in Europe, look at a lot of this change that's going on in America, whether it's the things we've talked about and Elon Musk and Donald Trump and all the stuff around protests and university funding, etc. And it kind of feels like an awful lot is decaying, or falling away very, very quickly. Is it to some extent, though, you know, the case that maybe we see some sort of pre-Trump America with rose-tinted glasses, whereas in reality, you know, the presidency was always kind of half-bought based on who could raise the most amount of money and funding. The state has incarcerated more people in prison than any other country in the world. It was never exactly massively other than. What would you say to that?
No, you're right. It's not like, you know, the devil is rampaging in the Garden of Eden here. I agree. The Congress was, you know, known as the broken branch of government. I think now you'd call it the completely severed branch of government. Money has always played an outsized role in American politics. Well, now it plays a sort of epic role if you look at the Musk-Trump relationship. So in some respects, you could describe what we're seeing as just a much worse version of what we had before. But I think it's not just a quantitative thing. This is qualitatively different.
The views there of Edward Luce, and since that interview, Elon Musk has deleted his controversial retweet about Hitler and Stalin and public servants.